It's now my privilege to introduce Eduardo Mendieta, and I think it's fair to say that if not for Eduardo's efforts, we would not be here today. He was instrumental in making the idea of this gathering a reality, and we're delighted that he's playing a central role in it. Eduardo Mendieta is professor of philosophy at the State University of New York, Stony Brook, and author of The Adventures of Transcendental Philosophy, as well as Global Fragments, Globalizations, Latin Americanisms, and Critical Theory. He recently co-edited Pragmatism, Nation, and Race, Community in the Age of Empire, which was published this year by Indiana University Press. And he is presently at work on another book entitled Philosophy's War. Professor Mendieta will introduce our next two distinguished speakers and will moderate our second panel. At 7:30, we'll move directly into our closing panel discussion when Jürgen Habermas and Charles Taylor will join Judith Butler and Cornel West for a collective discussion. Eduardo?
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you, Craig. Thank you to all the people who have made possible this event tonight, Sam, Ruthie, Evan, and the countless other people who have supported us to get here. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is my greatest joy and honor to welcome you this evening, to what is without question an intellectual, a philosophical, a political feast of the highest order. Welcome and thank you for joining us in this great exercise in publicness, in the performance of reason in the public sphere. We all have secret intellectual fantasies, our own private philosophical dreams. And I must confess that what has been happening tonight has been my fantasy for a very long time. Each one of tonight's speakers has been an intellectual and moral hero for me that have guided my philosophical, political, and moral development. And since I played a key role in bringing them together, I think I should give you a modicum of insight into this particular fantasy of mine. Besides, there is nothing I can say about the many books, honors, distinguished positions that both Professor Cornel West and Judith Butler have published, received, and hold that you already do not know, either by way of our program or by way of the internet. I met Cornel West and Judith Butler more than 15 years ago when I brought them together for another similar event. At the time, we got together to discuss what it meant to be a good citizen. That is, what did it mean to be a good American citizen in light of the issues that were concerning us, besieging us at the time: immigration, sexual difference, economic justice, religious pluralism, and a complicated set of ethnic and racial histories. At that time, in the early 90s, we were asking these questions in light of California Proposition 187, Clinton's Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and the then infamous Welfare Reform Act. It is sad, in retrospect, how little we have moved from those almost two-decade-old issues. Nonetheless, I think that in many ways, both Cornel West and Judith Butler have modeled not just the quintessential public intellectual, but also the good citizen. And as I say that, I wonder whether it makes sense to use that conjunctive, as if one could be a good citizen without being an intellectual, and be an intellectual without being a good citizen. Indeed, to be a good public intellectual citizen is precisely to live in accordance with Kant's challenge, sapere aude, dare to use your reason. Both Butler and West have dared us to use our reason publicly as citizens. Now, I think it was Richard Rorty, a good friend of us, who made popular the Hegelian formulation, philosophy is its own time comprehended in thought. But personally, I think no one like Judith Butler has demonstrated how it is that we can capture our time in thought, not so as to rationalize it, so as to provide an apologia for it, but so as to demonstrate that there is a violence in what we do as a society, as citizens of a particular polity, that goes against the grain of our most dearest and deepest moral convictions. To say that philosophy can comprehend our time in thought is to say that we can discern what is rational and not rational in our own social existence. At the same time, Judith Butler has led us to new levels of self-understanding and social enlightenment by demonstrating in the most subtle but also incisive and aphoristic formulations why we betray ourselves and others when we fail to see how our discourses, our rationalizations, are too often and too easily used to disavow our ethical responsibility for the suffering of others, especially of those who suffer because of us. Emmanuel Levinas claimed that ethics is prima philosophia. That is to say, that the meaning of the examined life is the attending to ethics, where ethics is always and above all responding to the clamoring of the suffering of others. Judith Butler has appropriated this profoundest of philosophical insights and translated it into the vernacular of U.S. English in engaged philosophical works that challenge our silence, our inaction, our moral callousness, and political torpitude. Now, some have criticized Professor Habermas in his moral and political philosophy for allegedly assuming that society is like a graduate philosophy seminar. Should we be that lucky? When I read that criticism, I don't think I understood what or who was being criticized. Analogously, I have heard it said and read it that Cornel Wells pretends we are all in a church listening to a sermon. Should we be that lucky if our intellectuals and politicians treated us with the moral and rational decency that our priests, chaplains, and rabbis treat us in their congregations? Cornel West has transformed the meaning of the public in public intellectual. He's a cultural icon, a rap philosopher, a jazz man, even an actor in what is surely one of the most philosophical of U.S. cinematographic productions of the last decade. If Socrates had been born in the U.S. at the fin de siècle, I am sure he would have gone around like Cornel West does, being a gadfly, a philosophical provocateur, a midwife of cultural enlightenment. Like Habermas, West has raised the level of public conversation in our society precisely because we can be and are better for bringing philosophy from the class and the academia into our public lives, just as Socrates did for Athens. The other day, in a seminar that Professor Habermas and I were teaching at Stony Brook, and I paraphrase, he asked the following question. He was trying to get us to the moment where citizens have to take responsibility for the normative claims of the society. And he says, there is a moment when you must ask the citizen, and why are you a citizen of this polity? Why, beyond the mere daily modus vivendi of mutual accommodation and passive tolerance, do you assent to belong to this commonwealth? Now I want to answer Professor Habermas's rhetorical question in this way. I became a U.S. citizen because there are citizens like Judith Butler and Cornel West that give me hope and inspiration in wanting to belong to a polity that would have them be their most respected public intellectuals. A polity with such voices and consciences can give us a modicum of self-respect and even pride. Thank you. Judith Butler will speak first. The title of her presentation, her talk, is Judaism Zionism? Religious sources for the critique of violence. And thereafter, Professor West will talk on prophetic religion and the future of capitalist civilization.
I was going to bring a step, but I forgot. I knew this would be a problem somehow. Okay. I'm very honored to be here. And And I'd like to express my sincere thanks to the organizers of this event for including me, especially Eduardo, who has been such an inspiration for all of us. I'm especially pleased to be here with Cornel West, my friend and my ally, and I savor the conversation with him already in advance. I'm neither a scholar of religion nor really of public life, but my thinking does intersect with this problem to the extent that I've been trying in the last years to consider the complex relationship between Judaism, Jewishness, and Zionism, as I know so many other people have as well. My own concern has been to find and foster the patience and perspicacity to think through some issues that seem to be confounded within public discourse. I'm not sure whether I have succeeded, but I do know that this is a most difficult and painstaking labor. A certain problem emerges between religion and public life when public criticism of Israeli state violence is taken to be anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish. For the record, I would like to make clear that some of those criticisms do employ anti-Semitic rhetoric and do engage anti-Semitic sentiment, although many of those criticisms do not, especially those, but not exclusively those, that emerge from within Jewish frameworks of social justice. My point is not to distinguish between these two kinds of criticism, although I think they must be distinguished, but to consider whether the public criticism of state violence, and I know that term is yet to be explained, is in some sense a Jewish thing to do. You will, I hope, forgive my initial flippancy here, but you will see the quandary I am trying to approach if you consider that if one openly and publicly criticizes Israeli state violence, then one is considered anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish in some quarters. And yet, to openly and publicly criticize such violence is in some ways an obligatory ethical demand from within certain Jewish frameworks, both religious and non-religious. Of course, you will already see a second set of quandaries introduced by this first formulation. As Hannah Arendt made clear in her early writings, Jewishness is not always the same as Judaism. And as she made clear in her evolving political position on the State of Israel, neither Judaism nor Jewishness necessarily leads to the embrace of Zionism. My aim is not to repeat the claim that Jews differ among themselves on the value of Zionism, on the injustice of the occupation, or on the military destructiveness of the Israeli state. These are complex matters, and there are vast disagreements on all of them. And my point is not to say simply that Jews are obligated to criticize Israel, although in fact I think they are, we are. Given that Israel acts in the name of the Jewish people and casts itself as the legitimate representative of the Jewish people, there's a question of what is done in the name of the Jewish people, and so all the more reason to reclaim that tradition and ethics in favor of another politics. The effort to establish the presence of progressive Jews runs the risk of remaining within a certain identitarian presumption, if not a fully narcissistic one. One opposes any and all expressions of anti-Jewish anti-Semitism, and one reclaims Jewishness for a project that seeks to dismantle Israeli state violence. Now, this particular form of the solution is, of course, challenged if we consider that within several ethical frameworks, Jewishness is itself an anti-identitarian project insofar as being a Jew, we might even say, that being a Jew implies taking up an ethical relation to the non-Jew. Indeed, if the relevant Jewish tradition for waging the public criticism of Israeli state violence is one that draws upon cohabitation as a norm of sociality, then what follows is the need not only to establish an alternative Jewish public presence, distinct from AIPAC, for instance, or an alternative Jewish movement, such as Jewish Voice for Peace, of which I am a part, but to affirm the displacement of identity that Jewishness is, as paradoxical as that may first sound. Only then can we come to understand the mode of ethical relationality that informs some key historical and religious understandings of what it is to be a Jew. In the end, it's not about specifying the ontology of the Jew over and against some other cultural or religious group. We have every reason to be suspect of any effort to do such a thing. It is rather a question of understanding the very relation to the non-Jew as the way of configuring religion in public life within Judaism. And it's on the basis of this conception of cohabitation that the critique of illegitimate nation-state violence can and must be waged. Now, of course, there are both risks and obligations of public criticism. It remains true that the criticism of Israeli state violence can be construed either as a critique of the Jewish state on the same grounds as one would criticize any other state that engaged in the same practices, occupation, invasion, destruction of a livable infrastructure for a minority population. Or it can be construed as the critique of the Jewish state, emphasizing the Jewishness of that state and raising the question of whether it is because the state is Jewish that it is criticized. This in turn raises the question of whether the criticism emerges because the state insists on one religious and ethnic group maintaining a demographic majority and creates differential levels of citizenship for majority and minority populations, and even internally prizes Ashkenazi origins and narrative accounts of the nation over Sephardic and Mizrahi cultural origins. But if the problem is this last one, it's still hard to enunciate this in public, since there will be those who suspect that really something else is going on, that really something else is being said, that anyone who calls into question the demand for Jewish demographic majority, in particular, is motivated by insensitivity to the sufferings of the Jewish people, including the contemporary threat they experience, or by antisemitism, or both. And of course, it makes a difference whether one is criticizing the principles of Jewish sovereignty that characterize political Zionism since 1948, or whether one's criticism is restricted to the occupation as illegal and destructive, and so situating oneself in a history that starts with 1967, or whether one is more restrictively criticizing certain military actions in isolation from both the question of Zionism and the question of the occupation. For example, the recent assault on Gaza and the war crimes committed there, the growth of settlements, or the policies of the current right-wing regime. But in each and every case, there is a question of whether the public criticism can be registered as something other than an attack on the Jews or on Jewishness. And depending where we are and to whom we speak, some of these positions can be heard more easily than others. And yet in every case, we are confronted with the limits on audibility by which the contemporary public sphere is constituted. There is always a question, you may have it right now, should I listen to this or not? Am I being heard or misconstrued? That's my question. The public sphere is constituted time and again through certain kinds of exclusions, images that cannot be seen, words that cannot be heard, and this means that the regulation of the visual and audible fields, along with the other senses, to be sure, is crucial to the constitution of what can become a debatable issue within the sphere of politics. If one says that one would be opposed to any state that restricted full citizenship to any religious or ethnic group at the expense of indigenous populations and all other cohabitants, then one might well be charged with not understanding the exceptional and singular character of the state of Israel, and more importantly, the historical reasons for claiming that exception. In effect, the formulation of classically liberal principles of citizenship that would forbid discrimination on the basis of race, religion, and ethnicity are construed as destructive of the Jewish state. And that formulation then resounds with destruction of the Jewish people, especially under the condition in which the Jewish state claims to represent the Jewish people. This view implicitly establishes classical liberalism as a potential form of genocide. The charge that such views lead to the destruction of the Jewish state illicitly draws upon the claim that these views lead to the destruction of the Jewish people, or more elliptically, the Jews. But it is clearly one thing to ask about the conditions under which Jews might live peaceably and productively with non-Jews, and to think about forms of governmental authority that might require a transition from the current form of government to another, and quite another to call for the violent destruction of a state or violence against its population. Indeed, the call to rethink, say, federal authority or binationalism for the region as a way of politically embodying principles of cohabitation may well be a way to envisage a way out of violence rather than a path to the destruction of any of the populations on that land. I think one has to return to certain diasporic traditions within Judaism in order not only to produce a public polyvalence for Jewishness that would effectively contest the right of Israel to represent Jewish interests, values, or politics, but also to reanimate certain ideals of cohabitation as the ethical basis for a public critique of those forms of state violence that seek to produce and maintain the Jewish character of the state through the radical disenfranchisement and decimation of its minority through occupation, assault, or legal restriction. These are attacks on a subjugated minority, but they are also attacks on cohabitation itself. So what do I mean by this term, cohabitation? Surely it implies something more robust than the claim that we all ought to get along or that neighborliness is a good idea. I'd like to devote what little time I have left this evening to thinking about Hannah Arendt, Jewish to be sure, but someone whose political views made many people doubt the authenticity of her Judaism or indeed Jewishness. Indeed, as a result of her salient criticisms of political Zionism and the State of Israel in 1944, 48, and 62, to name some of the major publication dates, her claim to belong to the Jewish people was severely doubted, most famously by Gershom Scholem. Scholem more quickly embraced a conception of political Zionism, whereas Martin Buber in the teens and 20s actively and publicly defended a spiritual and cultural Zionism that in his early view would have become perverted if it assumed the form of a political state. By the 1940s, Arendt, Buber and Magnus argued in favor of a binational state, proposing a federation in which Jews and Arabs would maintain their respective cultural autonomy. Of course, there are now other versions of binationalism that do not presume the monolithic cultural integrity of two peoples, as Buber has said, and I hope to gesture toward that at the end of my remarks. It's worth noting as well that Franz Rosenzweig elaborated as well a diasporic opposition to Zionism in his The Star of Redemption, in which he wrote that Judaism is fundamentally bound up with waiting and wandering, but not with the claim of territory. It was to this very diasporic version of Jewishness that Edward Said also referred in his book Freud and the Non-European, where he remarks that both Palestinians and Jews have an overlapping history of displacement, exile, living as refugees in diaspora among those who are not the same. This is a mode of living in which alterity is constitutive of who one is. And it was on the basis of these overlapping senses of the displacement, overlapping senses of displacement and heterogeneous cohabitation that Said proposed diaspora as a historical resource and guiding principle for a rethinking of what a just polity might be for those lands. Of course, there are distinctions to be made. Lots of activity. A competition out there. Of course, there are distinctions to be made between diaspora and exile, and debates about the status of the Galut, especially in relation to the history of Zionism. But for the moment, I want to set these aside to focus on the question of how the convergence of histories may constitute one meaning for cohabitation. Said did not clarify in what way these traditions of exile might be overlapping, but he was careful not to draw strict analogies. Does this suggest that one history might inform or interrupt another in ways that call for something other than comparison, parallelism, and analogy? Were Buber and Arendt thinking about a similar problem when, for instance, mindful of the massive numbers of refugees after the Second World War, they expressed their concerns about the establishment of a Jewish state in 1948 that would be based on the disenfranchisement and expulsion of Arabs as a national minority, one that turned out to expel more than 700,000 Palestinians. Arendt refused any strict historical analogy between the displacement of the Jews from Europe and those of the Palestinians from a newly established Israel. She surveyed, in fact, a number of historically distinct situations of statelessness in order to develop a general critique of the nation-state in The Origins of Totalitarianism in 1951. There she attempted to show how, for structural reasons, the nation-state produces mass numbers of refugees and must produce them in order to maintain the homogeneity of the nation it seeks to represent. In other words, to support the nationalism of the nation-state. This led her to oppose any state formation that sought to reduce or refuse the heterogeneity of its population, including the founding of Israel on principles of Jewish sovereignty. And it's clearly one reason she reflected on the post-sovereign and post-national promise of federalism. She thought that any state that failed to have the popular support of all its inhabitants and which defined citizenship on the basis of religious or national belonging would be forced to produce a permanent class of refugees. The critique extended to Israel, which she thought would find itself in endless conflict and heighten the danger to itself, and would perpetually lack legitimacy as a democracy grounded in popular will, especially in light of its continued reliance on what was once called superpowers to maintain its political power in the region. That Arendt moved from an analysis of a series of stateless conditions to a consideration of Palestine as a stateless condition is significant. The centrality of the European refugee situation, both under fascist Germany and after its demise, informs her politics here. But that is certainly not to say that Zionism is Nazism. She would have refused such an equation, and we should too. The point is that there are principles of social justice that can be derived from the Nazi genocide that can and must inform our contemporary struggles, even though the contexts are different and the forms of subjugating power clearly distinct. And Primo Levi clearly agreed with this as well, although I can't go into that here. I mean to suggest that cohabitation may be understood as a form of convergent exiles, and that very often we make a mistake by imagining that this convergence has to take the form of a strict analogy between separate historical conditions. If Said made that claim about the exilic condition of both Palestinian and Jewish peoples, Arendt made it differently when she wrote that the conditions of statelessness under the Nazi regime require a larger critique of how the nation-state perpetually produces the problem of mass refugees. She did not say that the historical situation under Nazi Germany was the same as the situation in Israel. Not at all. But the former was part, not all, of what led to her develop an historical account of statelessness in the 20th century and to derive general principles that oppose the reproduction of stateless persons and persons without rights. In some ways, she invoked the repetition of statelessness as the condition from which a critique of the nation state had to take place in the name of the heterogeneity of a population, political plurality, and a certain conception of cohabitation. It's clear that Jewish history comes to bear on Palestinian history in the context of settler colonialism. But is there yet another mode in which these histories come to bear upon one another, one that sheds another kind of light? Although I actually do think there are some religious sources for Arendt's political thought, I understand that I am a minority in this regard. It's clear that her early work on Augustine, for instance, focuses on neighborly love. And in the early writings on Zionism, she seeks recourse to the famous formulation of Hillel, "If I am not for myself, who will be for me? If I am not for others, what am I? And if not now, when?" But is there a way to understand the embrace of heterogeneity itself as a certain diasporic position, one conceptualized in part through the notion of a scattered population? The Kabbalistic tradition of scattered light, of the Sefirot, in some ways articulated this notion of a divine scattering that presupposes the persistence of the Jew with the non-Jew, among non-Jews. Although Arendt scorned explicit political forms of messianism, it may well be that the exilic tradition from which and about which she wrote was also bound up with a certain version of the messianic, one that interested her, for instance, in Benjamin's reading of Kafka. Over and against the messianic version of history that Scholem finally adopted, which provided a redemptive historical narrative for the establishment of the State of Israel, Arendt was clearly closer to Benjamin's counter-messianic view. And in that view, it was the suffering of the oppressed that flashed up during moments of emergency and that interrupted both homogeneous and teleological time. So here, I agree with Gabriel Peterberg's argument, for instance, that over and against Scholem, who understood the messianic finally as implying a return of the Jews to the land of Israel, what Scholem understood as a return from exile to history, Benjamin's theses on the concept of history constituted rather an ethical and political drive to redeem humanity's oppressed. As an effort to reverse the devalorization of exile, what is often called the galut within Zionist historiography, several scholars, including prominently Amnon Raz Krakotskin, focused their reading of Benjamin on the recognition and remembrance of the dispossessed. No one people can claim a monopoly on dispossession. The exilic framework for understanding the messianic provides a way to understand one historical condition of dispossession in light of another, forms of national historiography that imagine an internal history of the Jews are able neither to understand the exilic condition of the Jews nor the exilic consequences for the Palestinian under contemporary Zionism. Redemption itself is to be rethought as the exilic, according to this particular Benjaminian reading of Benjamin, the exilic without return, a disruption of teleological history, and an opening to convergent and interruptive sets of temporality. This is a messianism, perhaps secularized, that affirms the scattering of light, the exilic condition, as the non-teleological form that redemption now takes. This is a redemption from teleology. But how, we might surely ask, does the remembrance of one exile prompt an attunement to the dispossession of another? What is this transposition? Is it something other than historical analogy? And how does it take us to another notion of cohabitation? Now, Raz Krakotskin writes that the tradition of Benjamin's theses does not mobilize the memory of the oppression of the Jews in order to legitimate the present, but rather mobilizes that memory as a way of building a more general history of oppression. The generalization and transposability of that history of oppression is what leads to a politics that is committed to alleviating oppression in the present. And though Arendt clearly rejected all messianic versions of history, it's clear that her own resistance to the progress narrative of political Zionism was formed in part within terms offered by Benjamin. In her introduction to Benjamin's Illuminations, Arendt remarks that in the early 20s, Benjamin turned to Baroque tragic drama, a move which seemed to parallel, if not draw upon, Scholem's turn to the Kabbalah. Arendt suggests that throughout that work, Benjamin affirms that there's no return either to German, European, or Jewish traditions in their former condition. And yet something from Judaism, namely the exilic tradition, articulates this impossibility of return. Instead, something of another time flashes up in our own. Arendt writes that there was in his work of this time, and I quote, an implicit admission that the past spoke directly only through things that had been handed down, whose seeming closeness to the present was thus due precisely to their exotic character, I think she actually meant exoteric character, which ruled out all claims to a binding authority, end quote. She understood as theologically inspired Benjamin's conclusion that the truth could not be directly recovered and so could not be, quote, an unveiling which destroys the secret, but the revelation that does it justice, end quote. The revelation that does the secret justice seems to find resonance in that remark in the Theses on the Concept of History that, and I quote, the true picture of the past flits by. The past can be seized only as an image which flashes up at the instant when it can be recognized and is never seen again. Or later, to articulate the past historically does not mean to recognize it the way it really was, it means to seize hold of a memory as it flashes up at a moment of danger. The Messiah comes not only as the Redeemer, but as the subduer of the Antichrist. Okay, so for Benjamin, the Messiah is neither a person nor an historical event. It can be understood neither as anthropomorphism nor as teleology. It's rather a memory of suffering from another time that interrupts and reorients the politics of this time. It is memory that takes momentary shape as a form of light, recalling the Kabbalistic sefirot, those scattered and quasi-angelic illuminations that break up the suspect continuity of the present along with its amnesia. Benjamin makes clear in the 17th thesis that this flashing up makes it possible to effect a pause within historical development. Indeed, historiographies of inevitable historical development, a cessation of happening which can produce, in his words, a revolutionary chance in the fight for the oppressed past. A certain breaking apart of the amnesiac surface of time then opens onto and transposes the memory of suffering into the future of justice, not as revenge, but as the figuring of a time in which that history of oppression might be drawn to an end. In order to return us to the problem of how best to think about cohabitation, let me remind you of Arendt's famous final accusation against Eichmann in her controversial book, Eichmann in Jerusalem, published in 1962. According to Arendt, Eichmann thought that he and his superiors might choose with whom to cohabit the earth. They failed to realize that the heterogeneity of the earth's population is an irreversible condition of social and political life itself. The accusation bespeaks a firm conviction that none of us should be in the position of making such a choice, that with whom we cohabit the earth is something that is given to us prior to choice, and so prior to any social or political contracts we might enter into through volition. In fact, if we seek to make a choice where there is no choice, we are trying to destroy the conditions of our own social and political life. In Eichmann's case, the effort to choose with whom to cohabit the earth was an explicit effort to annihilate some part of that population, Jews, gypsies, homosexuals, communists, the disabled, and the ill, among others. And so the exercise of freedom upon which he insisted was genocide. If Arendt is right, then it's not only that we may not choose with whom to cohabit, but that we must actively preserve the non-chosen character of inclusive and plural cohabitation. We not only live with those we never chose and to whom we may feel no sense of social belonging, but we are also obligated to preserve those lives and the plurality of which they form a part. In this sense, concrete political norms and ethical prescriptions emerge from the unchosen character of those modes of cohabitation. To cohabit the earth is prior to any possible community or nation or neighborhood. We might choose where to live and who to live by, but we cannot choose with whom to cohabit the earth. In Eichmann in Jerusalem, she clearly speaks out not only for the Jews, but for any other minority who would be expelled from habitation on the earth by another group. The one implies the other, and the speaking for universalizes the principle, even as it does not override the plurality for which it speaks. Arendt refuses to separate the Jews from the other so-called nations persecuted by the Nazis in the name of a plurality. She speaks in the name of a plurality that is coextensive with human life in any and all of its cultural forms. Is she subscribing here to a universal principle, or does plurality form a substantial alternative to the universal? And is her procedure in some ways related to the problem of convergent and interrupting histories mentioned by Said and Benjamin in different ways? Perhaps we can say that there is in her formulation a universalization at work that seeks to establish inclusiveness for all human society, but which posits no single defining principle for the humanity it assembles. The notion of plurality cannot be only internally differentiated, since that would raise the question of what bounds this plurality. That boundary would establish not only an inside but an outside, and plurality cannot be exclusionary without losing its plural character. The idea of a given or established form of plurality would pose a problem for the claims of plurality. It's clear that for Arendt, non-human life already constitutes part of that outside, thus denying from the start the animality of the human. But she already did that in The Human Condition, as we know. Any present notion will have to be differentiated on some basis from a future one. And if plurality does not exclusively characterize a given and actual condition, but also always a potential one, then it has to be understood as a process, and we will need to shift from a static to a dynamic conception. Following William Connolly, we could then speak of pluralization. Only then can the differentiation that characterizes a given plurality also mark those set of differences that exceed its givenness. The task of affirming or even safeguarding plurality would then also imply making new modes of pluralization possible. So when Arendt universalizes her claim, no one has the right to decide with whom to cohabit the earth, everyone has the right to cohabit the earth with equal degrees of protection, she does not assume that everyone is the same, at least not in the context of her discussion of plurality. I mean, one can surely see why there would be a Kantian reading of Arendt, one that concludes that plurality is a regulative ideal, that everyone has such rights regardless of the cultural and linguistic differences by which they are characterized. And Arendt herself moves in a Kantian direction, although, interestingly enough, a direction that takes her to Kant's aesthetics, more importantly than his moral philosophy. But I think there's another point to be made here, one that honors the distinction between pluralization and universalization. And the distinction is important for thinking about unchosen cohabitation. Equal protection, or indeed equality, is not a principle that homogenizes those to whom it applies. Rather, the commitment to equality is a commitment to the process of differentiation itself. One can surely see why there can be a communitarian reading of Arendt, since she herself elaborates the right to belong and the rights of belonging. But there is always a redoubling here. Everyone has the right of belonging. And this means that there's a universalizing and a differentiating that takes place at once and without contradiction. And this is the structure of pluralization. In other words, political rights are separated from the social ontology upon which they depend. Political rights universalize, although they do so always in the context of a differentiated and continually differentiating population. And though Arendt refers to nations or sometimes communities of belonging as the component parts of this plurality, it's clear that the principle of pluralization applies as well to these parts, since they are not only internally differentiated and differentiating, but they are themselves defined in relation to variable and shifting relations to the outside. Indeed, this is one point I have been trying to underscore about the problem of Jewishness. It may be that the sense of belonging to that group entails taking up a relation to the non-Jew, whatever that might be, and that this mode of approaching the problem of alterity is fundamental to what it is to belong to Jewishness itself. In other words, to belong is to undergo a dispossession from the category. As paradoxical as that might seem, it is, we might say, an exilic moment that becomes definitional and which also becomes the condition of an ethical relation. It's only possible to struggle to alleviate the suffering of others if I am both motivated and dispossessed by my own suffering. It's this relation to the other that dispossesses me from my enclosed and self-referential notion of belonging. Otherwise, we cannot understand those obligations that bind us when there is no obvious mode of belonging and where the convergence of temporalities becomes the condition for the memory of political dispossession, as well as the resolve to bring such dispossession to a halt. Can we now think about that transposition that happens from the past to the future? precisely because there is no common denominator among the plural members of this stipulated humanity in Arendt's work, except perhaps the ungrounded right to have rights, which includes a certain right to belonging and to place. We can only begin to understand this plurality by testing a set of analogies that will invariably fail. In fact, precisely because one historical experience of dispossession is not the same as another, the right to have rights emerges invariably in different forms and through different vernaculars. If we start with the presumption that one group's suffering is like another group's, we have not only assembled the groups into provisional monoliths, but we have launched into a form of analogy building that invariably fails. The specificity of the group is established at the expense of its temporal and spatial instability, its constitutive heterogeneity, and for the purpose of making it suitable for analogical reasoning. But analogy fails because the specificities prove obdurate. The suffering of one people is not exactly like the suffering of another, and this is the condition of the specificity of the suffering for both. Indeed, we would have no analogy between them if the grounds for analogy were not already destroyed, and if specificity qualifies each group for analogy, it also defeats the analogy from the start. Indeed, I think so many of our political arguments rest are driven by the need to establish analogy, and I think, in fact, it's unnecessary. The obstruction that thwarts analogy makes that specificity plain and becomes the condition for the process of pluralization. Through elaborating a series of broken or exhausted analogies, the communitarian presumption that we might start with groups as our point of departure meets its limit. And then the internally and externally differentiating action of pluralization emerges as a clear alternative. We might try to overcome such failures by devising more perfect analogies, hoping that a common ground can be achieved in that way. Multicultural dialogue with an aim of perfect consensus, or intersectional analysis in which every factor is included in the final picture. But such procedures miss the point that plurality implies differentiations that cannot be and should not be overcome through ever more robust epistemological accounts or ever more refined analogies. At the same time, the elaboration of rights, especially the right of cohabitation on the earth, emerges as a universal that governs a social ontology that cannot be homogenized. Such a universalizing right has to break up into its non-universal conditions, otherwise it fails to be grounded in plurality. I'm almost done. Arendt seeks something other than principles to unify this plurality, and she clearly objects to any effort to divide this plurality, although it is by definition internally differentiated. The difference between division and differentiation is clear. It's one thing to repudiate some part of this plurality, to bar admission of that part into the plurality of the human, and to deny place to that portion of humanity. It's quite another to recognize the failed analogies by which we have to make our way politically. Our suffering is never the same as another suffering. At the same time, any and all suffering, by virtue of forcible displacement and statelessness, is equally unacceptable. If we are to allow the memory of dispossession to crack the surface of historical amnesia and reorient us toward the unacceptable conditions of refugees across time and space, there must be transposition without analogy. The interruption of one time by another, which is the counter-nationalist impetus of the messianic, in Benjamin's terms, what some would call a messianic secularism. One time breaks into another. This is not the same as analogy, but neither is it the temporality of trauma in which times become conflated with one another. It may be that the very possibility of ethical relation depends upon a certain condition of dispossession from national modes of belonging, a dispossession that characterizes our relationality from the start, and so the possibility of any ethical relation. We are outside ourselves, before ourselves, and only in such a mode is there a chance of being for another. We are, to be sure, already in the hands of the other before we make any decision about with whom we choose to live. This way of being bound to one another is precisely not a social bond that is entered into through volition and deliberation. It precedes contract, is mired in dependency, and is often effaced by those forms of social contract that depend on an ontology of volitional individuals. It is thus even from the start to the stranger that we are bound, the one or the ones we never knew and never chose. If we accept this sort of ontological condition, or indeed what Levinas would call pre-ontological, then to destroy the other is to destroy my life, that sense of my life that is invariably social life. This may not be our common condition, but more likely our convergent conditions, ones of proximity, adjacency, up againstness, ones of being interrupted by the memory of someone else's longing and suffering in spite of oneself. Since there is no home without adjacency, and no way to reside anywhere without the outside defining the space of inhabitation, the co of cohabitation cannot be thought simply as spatial neighborliness. There is dependency and differentiation, proximity and violence, and this is what we find in some explicit ways in the relation between territories such as Israel and Palestine, since they are joined inextricably without binding contract, without reciprocal agreement, and yet ineluctably. So the question emerges, what obligations are to be derived from this dependency, contiguity, and proximity that now defines each population, which exposes each to the fear of destruction, which, as we know, sometimes incites destructiveness? How are we to understand such bonds without which neither population can live and survive, and to what post-national obligations do they lead? Practically, I think none of these views can be dissociated from the ongoing violent project of settler colonialism, which I think is the continuing practice of political Zionism. To practice remembrance in the Benjaminian sense would, I think, lead to a new concept of citizenship, a new constitutional basis for that region, a rethinking of binationalism in light of the racial and religious complexity of both Jewish and Palestinian populations, a radical reorganization of land partitions and illegal property allocations, and even minimally, a concept of cultural heterogeneity that extends to the entire population and which is protected rather than denied by rights of citizenship. Now, one might argue against all these propositions that they are unreasonable to speak in public, that they carry too much risk, that equality would be bad for the Jews, that democracy would stoke anti-Semitism, and that cohabitation would threaten Jewish life with destruction. But perhaps these responses are only utterable on the condition that we fail to remember what Jewishness means, or that we have not thought carefully enough about all the possible permutations of never again. After all, remembrance does not restrict itself to my suffering or the suffering of only one people, even if those people suffered in the concentration camps. The limit on what can be remembered is enforced in the present through what can be said, what can be heard, the limits on the audible that constitute the public sphere. For remembrance to break through that public sphere would be one way for religion, perhaps, to enter into public life, a politics, Jewish and not Jewish, and indeed beyond that binary, neither Jewish nor not Jewish, indeed a field of increasing differentiations, unconstrained by the universalization of its political principles. Such a politics might then emerge in the name of remembrance, both from and against dispossession, and in the direction of what one may yet call justice. Thank you.